listening to West Virginia Week, a regular podcast from West Virginia Public Broadcasting that looks back at the major stories of the week. I'm your host this week, Maria Young. On this West Virginia Week, an annual report from WVU gives some insight into crime and safety on campus. Also, a new plan aims to make West Virginia more competitive when it comes to science and technology grants. A local effort to prevent overdose deaths has grown to a nationwide phenomenon. And a green lumpy fruit native to West Virginia is having its moment. Whether you think it tastes like mangoes or pineapples or something in between, the popular pawpaw is the newest soft drink flavor around. Let's jump right in now with a few short news stories. The West Virginia Public Service Commission's consumer advocate is asking the commission to take another look at Appalachian Power's coal supply. Curtis Tate has more.
The consumer advocate says Appalachian Power's coal inventory remains bloated and projects it will continue to cost electricity customers more than necessary. It wants the PSC to reconsider its decision last month to not reprimand the company for ordering too much coal at high prices and burning it at a loss to customers. An expert witness testified to the commission that Appalachian Power lost $81 million in the 12 months ending in February at its Amos, Mountaineer, and Mitchell plants. The company says it cannot let its coal piles grow too large for worker safety reasons, and running the plants when they can't make money is a way to prevent that. Breaking contracts with coal suppliers could cost customers more, it says. The commission last month denied Appalachian Power's application to raise rates. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
7 months after deadly flooding tore out their bridge, a small community along the Tug Fork River in McDowell County has had physical access restored to their neighborhood. Governor Patrick Morrissey joined local partners Wednesday to announce the completion of a new access road for residents of Sunburst Drive. The neighborhood's only entry point, a bridge connecting to the Black Diamond Highway, collapsed during the flooding. Residents previously told WVPB that they had resorted to walking a mile out along the train tracks. After it was determined that the bridge was not state-owned and therefore not eligible to be repaired with state funds, the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection partnered with local government and several private businesses to construct an alternate route into the community. It is estimated state agencies have completed 208 projects totaling $20.3 million in state resources, labor, and equipment to help restore safety and stability in McDowell County. West Virginia is a top 10 state in the growth of energy jobs. As Curtis Tate reports, they're not in fossil fuels.
West Virginia was among the top 10 states in 2024 for growth in clean energy jobs. That's according to E2, a national policy group that promotes clean energy policies. Clean energy jobs in West Virginia grew nearly 5% in 2024, putting it between Texas and Florida, which were top 10 states in all categories E2 measured. West Virginia had just under 11,000 clean energy jobs last year. That includes renewable generation, storage and grid, energy efficiency, biofuels, and clean vehicles. West Virginia was also a top 10 state in the growth of renewable generation jobs in 2024. The number of jobs in wind, solar, geothermal, bioenergy, and hydropower grew by almost 8%. Nationwide, renewable generation jobs vastly outnumbered those in fossil fuel generation. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
Nearly $20 million in new grants are now available for groups looking to prevent substance use disorder and support recovery across the state. The West Virginia First Foundation has officially opened its application portal for the Momentum Initiative grant. Applications must be submitted by noon on Friday, October the 10th. This deadline differs from the previous cycle to ensure WVFF staff are available to support applicants throughout the submission process. Fundings will be distributed across five target areas, including foster care and non-parental caregivers, youth prevention, recovery housing, behavioral health and workforce development, and day report centers and reentry programs. Visit wvfirst.org for more information. Marshall and local high school students got a chance Tuesday to hear the Supreme Court of Appeals of West Virginia hold arguments at the Joan C. Edwards Performing Arts Center. Emma Johnson has more.
Marshall University is the first of two West Virginia schools the West Virginia Supreme Court is visiting this September. Patricia Proctor, founding director of the Simon Perry Center for Constitutional Democracy, says the court on campus program can give students a better understanding of how the court operates.
This is something everyone will remember and gain better understanding of what a court does, and that's part of being an educated citizen.
Proctor says the ultimate goal in bringing the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals to Marshall's campus is to give each student a better understanding of how the judicial system works. For more information, visit our website at wvpublic.org. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Emma Johnson in Huntington.
Vacancy rates in the state's child welfare workforce have been lowered significantly since the first of the year, according to a press release from the West Virginia Department of Human Services. As of September 1, 2025, the statewide vacancy rate for Child Protective Services positions has dropped from 12% to 8.5%. 2 years ago, that rate was more than 27%. In January, critical vacancies in CPS were identified across Doddridge, Pleasance, Upshur, Lewis, and Ritchie counties. In response, DOHS launched a series of targeted initiatives that reduced vacancy rates by 30% as of June 30, 2025. To learn more about the child welfare programs at DOHS, visit humanservices.wv.gov. Over a two-day period earlier this week, 12 people were arrested by West Virginia State Police for alleged immigration violations. The arrest by the State Police Parkway's interdiction team came Sunday and Monday during traffic stops along Interstate 77 in Fayette County. Troopers were working with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents as part of a partnership announced by Governor Patrick Morrissey last month. In his 6 months as commander of the Parkway's authority, Captain Andy Evans says the turnpike gets a lot of international drivers, and troopers use phone apps to communicate with those who can't speak English.
We've had MS-13 members that we've had out here. We've had people that's been wanted from other jurisdictions for other crimes. They would be fugitives. There is a large number that are here that's just undocumented.
The 12 arrested earlier this week were taken to the South Central Regional Jail in Charleston. There's a new plan designed to make West Virginia more competitive when it comes to science and technology grants and create a skilled workforce that will attract high-paying industries. After months of collaboration, the West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission has released its new Science and Technology Plan. Vision 2030 is a blueprint of sorts for advancing education, research, and innovation that strengthens research and industry. It focuses on four key areas of growth, including, new this year, artificial intelligence and machine learning. Janet Rohrer is the Commission's Senior Director for Science, Technology, and Research.
We're excited about working to advance and really diversify the growth of West Virginia's economy, utilizing research and innovation and the STEM talent that we have in our state.
Vision 2030 also allows West Virginia to qualify for grant funds through the National Science Foundation to help support those goals. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Maria Young in Charleston. 9th and 10th grade students in five southern West Virginia counties will learn a lesson this week they won't find in any textbooks. On Thursday and Friday, Gear Up Southern West Virginia will host two Commitment to Graduate events for students in Mercer, Monroe, Raleigh, Summers, and Wyoming counties. But in these high-poverty regions, they also want participants to learn now how important the post-secondary steps are. Otherwise, says Interim Director Sheila Barnhart-Womack, they're likely to quickly hit a salary ceiling.
Not only is there potential for upward mobility if you have that training, having a certificate, a two-year degree, a four-year degree, something is going to give you a leg up so that you can continue to advance and continue to earn more.
12 high schools will participate in the programs, which are funded through the U.S. Department of Education. The federal government has recognized a historically black West Virginia university for its international exchanges. Chris Schultz has more.
Bluefield State University has been named a Fulbright Historically Black College and University Institutional Leader for 2025. It is the fifth time the university has received this recognition for its engagement in the Fulbright Program, the U.S. government's International Academic Exchange Initiative. Bluefield President Darren Martin said in a press release that the recognition underscores the school's mission to prepare students for leadership in a global society. Over the past 20 years, Bluefield has hosted Fulbright scholars and residents from Russia, Liberia, and India, as well as Fulbright language assistants for Arabic, Russian, and Swahili. The Fulbright program operates in more than 160 countries worldwide, with funding from the U.S. government and support from participating governments, host institutions, and private partners. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
An annual report from WVU gives some insight into crime and safety on the school's main campus. Chris Schultz has the details.
West Virginia University published its annual Security and Fire Safety Report Tuesday, better known as a Clery Act report. Signed in 1990, the Clery Act requires all colleges and universities that participate in federal financial aid programs to keep and disclose information about crime on and near their campuses. The report collects data for the flagship Morgantown campus, as well as two health science campuses and the School of Nursing in Bridgeport. In the main crime categories, 2024 statistics largely remained in line with the previous year, except for reports in three categories. Burglaries, which increased from 10 in 2023 to 25 in 2024. Domestic violence, which increased from 24 in 2023 to 32 in 2024. And stalking, which increased from 24 in 2023 to 42 in 2024. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
West Virginia State University is celebrating not one but two milestones in its history as a land-grant university. Chris Schultz reports.
This year, West Virginia State University is celebrating 135 years of the 1890 land-grant university system, as well as 25 years since regaining its land-grant status in 2020. The system of land-grant schools, established to provide federal support for agricultural and technical educational institutions in every state, was expanded in 1890 to ensure the education of black citizens. But in 1956, shortly after desegregation, the State Board of Education voted to surrender WVSU's land-grant status. University President Eric Cage says restoration of the status has brought millions of dollars to the institution and helped them support the entire state.
When I say that regaining the status has been and will continue to be transformative for our university, it is not an understatement.
Cage says the school has a very bright future with its land-grant heritage as a beacon. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown.
You're listening to West Virginia Week. And now, some of the top feature stories from this past week. Thursday was Save a Life Day, which has grown from two West Virginia counties into a nationwide event. Curtis Tate spoke with three Charleston advocates of harm reduction about the importance of preventing overdose deaths.
At the office of the Unitarian Universalist Church on Charleston's west side, Sarah Stone, the co-director of SORA West Virginia, is on the porch putting together overdose kits. They contain doses of naloxone, which can be used to save people from a fatal drug overdose.
Everyone needs to have naloxone, no matter who you think you are. Always having it's better than not having it.
Joe Solomon, a Charleston City Council member, says sponsors have enabled the distribution of 2,000 naloxone kits across the state and the country. He says it should be normal for it to be available anywhere.
Good spots for these are everywhere. A restroom, a convenience store, a restaurant, a bar, a church.
Save a Life Day started small, in just two counties. Now it's all over the state and the country.
All 50 states are now taking part for the first time. All 55 West Virginia counties as well. And all 55 West Virginia counties, you know, Lake helped coordinate the all 55 counties just a couple years ago, got them all ready, as well as all 13 Appalachian states. And it's grown from here in West Virginia, Appalachia, to now all the states, including states you thought might be tricky to get on board, but weren't really, including Hawaii and Alaska. They're squarely on the map.
Fatal overdoses have fallen in West Virginia, according to federal data, but the addiction crisis continues. Last week, the city of Charleston alone recorded 35 overdoses in a 24-hour period. No one died, thanks in part to the availability of naloxone.
Yeah, it feels kind of meaningful that the state that's been leading the country with its overdose rate for as long as I think most of us can remember, is, you know, get something that we can be really proud of. this thing that started as a two-county pilot here in the heart of West Virginia, Kanawha, Putnam, and then spread to the hardest hit counties. So the next year after that, it was 17 hard hit West Virginia counties. The year after that, it was all 55 West Virginia counties. It just kept blooming. And I think it's just something that's been tended by West Virginians, tended by Appalachians.
Lake Sedikman, the harm reduction program coordinator at the Women's Health Center of West Virginia, says everyone should have naloxone and know how to use it.
I mean, one day I was walking my dog at a park and a neighbor, someone I, you know, vaguely recognized, came running up to me and said, "Do you have naloxone?" And I was like, "Yeah, I do. I have some in my purse." And they had found someone who had overdosed, and we both ran over there and were able to, you know, use the naloxone on that person and get them, you know, back up breathing and conscious. And so you just never know.
Another thing Sedikman points out, naloxone doesn't really go bad.
I always tell people, don't throw away expired naloxone. If you're concerned about the expiration, you can definitely get some fresh stuff, but keep the expired naloxone, because the worst thing that could happen is that it's a little bit less effective.
Stone says naloxone that's kept outside can freeze in the winter, but that's easy to fix.
And if you find yourself in a position where you think, oh, this might be frozen, just sticking it in your armpit for a second or between your thighs for a second, just for a minute to get it thawed out, and then use it.
Stone says the naloxone boxes that are outside in Charleston are replenished frequently.
While they go very quickly, they're not outside for very long. We're not at all worried about if the naloxone is still good based on temperature.
Solomon says organizers only found out earlier this week that Save a Life Day had reached 1,000 events.
It's just been an exponential kind of curve since the beginning. I mean, last year it was 600-something, and I kind of thought that's where it would simmer around.
Solomon says naloxone was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 1971, the same year Starbucks was founded.
And so what we've been trying to do here in Kanawha County, but certainly in all other 54 counties these last few years, is turn this antidote into more than just an antidote, but really a movement so that we can normalize naloxone and make sure that it's everywhere.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
The West Virginia Department of Human Services spent much of this summer touring the state and listening to more than 350 participants from 44 counties who have all been impacted by the child welfare system here, including biological parents, grandparents, relatives, foster parents, judges, and caseworkers. Earlier this month, the department released an extensive report on its findings. Human Services Secretary Alex Mayer spoke with us about those findings and the next steps. Thank you for making time to talk with me about the listening tour and the results. You all put out a pretty comprehensive, I have a copy of it. I made the mistake of printing it out, and it took almost the entire ream of paper that we had in the printer.
Yeah.
So it's pretty comprehensive.
We spent a lot of time, and I was really happy with the results and being able to capture I think not only the themes, but I think one of the key focuses that we wanted to do was really give persona to, the type of person or the people that, came out and offered such great insights and perspective.
Yeah, I thought in the report, one of the groups that we don't often hear from is biological parents. And the woman who said, yes, I've made these mistakes, but wow, have I worked hard to get my life back on track so that I can be a good parent. And it sure did feel like nobody was listening, and it was never good enough. And, I thought that was an interesting perspective. And I also thought we might see numbers that suggest that CPS workers are overwhelmed, look at the number of cases they have, but we don't often hear from them. And there was, I think, a caseworker who said, I don't need any more trainings. I need support in a different way. So those were some voices that, I think we don't often hear that were included in your report. Were there some others?
Well, we also, we had virtual sessions with judges, prosecutors, JALs. I mean, really anyone that touches the system. And that was really our goal. Our goal was to be able to meaningfully engage with every single person or type of, individual. Again, whether that be a biological parent, a kinship family, a provider, right? I mean, any single person that's involved in the child welfare system and ensured those in the public felt like their voices were heard.
If you would summarize just briefly some of the bullet point findings that came from this report.
You know, obviously communication. Communication continues to be something that we hear a lot about throughout the child welfare process. And I would say that would be one major theme that came out. Obviously, the supports for kinship and other and foster parents. I think there's a lot of opportunity there for us to do more in the way that we're supporting those families. And largely, I think that comes down to our ability to meaningfully connect with the communities and other partners within those communities that can help assist in wrapping around those families. And that can even be biological families that might be involved in a church or another community-based organization. Another thing I think we don't often hear is from the voices of the children involved in the system, right? And there is a real clear opportunity for us to do more intentional work around including their voice. We're going to have, you know, regular engagements with kids who are involved in the foster care system or were previously involved in the foster care system to help provide us more meaningful insights. A lot of great things came out of the conversation. I think another thing was around staff and the workforce. You know, that's an area we've given a lot of attention to and continue to pour a lot of attention to ensure that not only the work of our staff is better, but also too, that the work that we are doing is even more impactful and we're able to provide even better service to the citizens of West Virginia.
That was DOHS Secretary Alex Mayer. To access the full report, visit our website at wvpublic.org. Since 1994, Kentucky State University has been the U.S. Department of Agriculture's gene bank for a tropical-like fruit that thrives in Kentucky and here in West Virginia, the pawpaw. John McGarry reports.
After 3 weeks with no rain, a trickle irrigation system is watering a pawpaw patch at Kentucky State University's Benson Research and Demonstration Farm. Dr. Kirk Popper, a professor of horticulture at KSU, says the farm is home to about 10,000 pawpaw trees spread across 12 acres.
You'll find them especially along streams and in the valleys, and they like a little water. They don't want to be flooded for long periods of time. They will grow along these stream beds, drop their fruit into the water, and you know, the fruit will spread that way.
It's September 3rd, and some pawpaws have fallen to the ground. Popper pulls a few off branches, and we dig in. The reporter, for the first time.
Try this one, too. This is Susquehanna Sweeter.
Oh, this is different than the first one.
Yep.
What kind is this?
Susquehanna. Another one with sunflower.
Popper says not all pawpaws are created equally. Some don't taste as good as others. At KSU, there are 50 grown varieties plus seedlings. All have short shelf lives, about 2 weeks in a refrigerator, something Popper and company are trying to address.
We've done a lot of different variety trials just to kind of see what grows best in Kentucky. And then we've also been kind of a collection site for material from all around the nation. And we've used that in some breeding efforts.
Last year around this time, another person who'd never tasted pawpaw came to the Benson farm. Daphne Phipps is the director of product excellence and innovations for the Winchester soft drink company, Ale 81.
To me, it was the most delicious, complex fruit I'd ever tasted. As soon as I thought I figured out what it tasted like, the flavor changed, if that makes sense. So when I first started tasting it, to me, it was mango forward. And then as soon as I had mango in my mind, it started switching to pineapple. And
some call it a Kentucky banana. However, the variety made Phipps' mission more difficult, finding the proper mix of natural flavors for the company's limited time only, or LTO, pawpaw drink. She brought home a large bag full of pawpaws and emptied it in 2 days so she could remember and replicate it in L81's lab. 8 months and 49 formulas later, she thought she had a winner. According to Popper, perhaps the world's preeminent pawpaw expert, she did.
I think the pawpaw L81 is an excellent drink. I think it really does capture, especially KSU Chappelle, but captures pawpaw. And so I think it's a great drink on its own, but it's also a great mixer, too.
Back in Winchester, Ale81 began bottling the Pawpaw LTO for its August 4th release. Chief Marketing Officer Kevin Price says they quickly sold every bottle to stores throughout Kentucky and its 7 border states. Still, he says it's too soon to say whether they'll bring it back.
it's all about the fans. And if the fans are reacting in a more enthusiastic way, we have to pay attention. So we are paying attention.
Phipps says the pawpaw variety sold 48% faster than any other L81 LTO. What's more, it's raised interest in what she calls little green potatoes to the benefit of the 90-plus commercial growers in Kentucky. People like Matt Minigato, owner of the Hang Loose Pawpaw Patch in Wilmore, that just began producing fruit this year.
There's been a huge uptick in calls, emails, text messages, the whole nine yards.
So I think we're going to go ahead and get started now. So I'm going to ask.
It's September 10th, and KSU is hosting the International Pawpaw Conference, four or five of which have been held there. This reporter is about to try his first Pawpaw Ale 8.
That's pretty good.
And Kirk Popper is about to receive the fruit of 27 years in pawpaw patches. At the request of KSU President Kofi Akapo, a new pawpaw cultivar developed at KSU is given a name.
KSU Popper's choice is a fitting tribute to his vision, his dedication to pawpaw growers, and his extraordinary contributions to horticultural science.
I'm John McGarry at KSU's Benson Research and Demonstration Farm.
This story was produced as part of the Appalachian Mid-South Newsroom, a collaboration between NPR and several public radio stations in West Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Visit the special series page under the News tab on our website to find a link to this story and more. And that's it for this edition of West Virginia Week. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you back here again next week. As always, you can see these stories and more at wvpublic.org. I'm Maria Young.